Thundergrunt.
Great, how are you?
Good.
I'm Bob Rose, and I'm a filmmaker and working editor.
I'm Jimmy George. I'm a full-time script consultant and screenwriter.
And I'm Jamie Nash. I am a screenwriter.
Today we're going to talk about a certified American classic, right? We're not going to talk about any of the stuff that people normally talk about.
With Poltergeist.
Yeah. We're going to talk about the script.
Yeah, the script, the story.
The script, yeah. We're not going to talk about everything that Google would show you if you looked it in the bar.
I think it's Sam Rockwell's best movie.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, I really, really enjoyed that's like that and Charlie's Angels are the two tops. I actually kind of don't hate the remake.
I like the remake.
I kind of enjoyed it.
The Poltergeist remake?
Yeah.
Or the Charlie's Angels remake?
Oh, have we had that yet?
Well, it was a remake.
Yeah, the movie it's a remake of a TV show.
Oh, I thought you... Okay. Well, see, look, I'm thinking about the remake they'll eventually do.
Yeah, because
the
they're going movies. To do that, yes.
Right. I think there might be one in the works.
And also, don't want to argue, but the movies were technically an extension of the TV show, not a remake.
Okay, that's true. That's
it was
true.
Actually Charlie from the TV show. Let's talk about Poltergeist though. Jamie.
Yeah, Poltergeist. What are we talking about?
We're talking about who wrote this screenplay.
Who wrote the screenplay? You know, I didn't realize who wrote the screenplay. I'm kind of embarrassed to admit that I just always thought Steven Spielberg wrote the screenplay.
I know. I looked up those other guys and I feel really bad. They had a bunch of projects with I'm not even saying their names. That's so shitty.
Well,
do you know their names? Did you write them down?
I did not write them down. And shame, shame, shame.
See, we all showed up for a Poltergeist podcast. I'm like, yeah, it's easy. It's Poltergeist.
Well, interestingly enough, when I did some research on this script, because again, I always just thought it was Spielberg. I always knew it was a splinter off of Night Skies, which Night Skies was supposedly a sequel to Close Encounters he was going to work on.
It's a really interesting read if you ever look that up. What it could have been.
It's out there. And it's, I think it's a true story of a famous alien invasion case, a farmhouse. And these monster aliens attack the farmhouse, you know. So he was going to do the horror Close Encounters.
Some people also link it to Close Encounters, right?
Close Encounters, yeah. But when they canned it, so and there's also a lot of things like Rick Baker hated him because Rick Baker put $700,000 of his money into designing the monster aliens.
Jeez.
And he came up with this really cool monster alien. And then Spielberg, when he was on the set of Raiders, decided not to do an evil alien movie. And instead, the idea kind of splintered off into Poltergeist and E.T. The legend goes that he read the script on the Raiders set to Melissa Matheson. And they had this character that was a lot like... who's the good guy? The Mogwai.
Gizmo?
Gizmo.
Gizmo.
He was a lot like Gizmo. They had a good alien that was part of the bad ones. And there was the good one. And then there were the evil ones that kind of attacked. And they had names like Spike and stuff like that. They had these names. And when she heard this heartfelt story of the good alien, her and Steven kind of bonded over that. And that was kind of the genesis for E.T. I've heard that story. I don't know how true
it is. I mean, in the end, it seems like he made the right choice.
Yeah.
You can't argue that E.T. was the
wrong
choice.
How did that lead to Poltergeist then?
So they took that script and kind of made E.T., but then they also took the family under siege kind of aspects.
Okay.
And supposedly that was some inspiration towards Poltergeist. However, when I was researching, that's what I always heard. When I was researching this podcast, there was a website out there that's all about Poltergeist, and I'd give its name if I had it. Again, poor research. But it said that Toby Hooper initially had the idea for Poltergeist. Like, they both wanted to do a movie together. Toby Hooper had some ideas of doing like a haunted house kind of movie.
Okay.
And he had some of the initial, and they went back and forth via mail. They didn't have email at the time. And then
can you imagine?
Spielberg took the ball and wrote the first treatment for Poltergeist.
Okay.
And that treatment was somewhat different. It was similar but different. It had the suburbs. It might have had some television stuff. I think it's out there. I think you can find this treatment.
I bet you can.
I don't think it had Carol Ann being kidnapped.
Okay.
I think there was a possession element in it. So it was maybe a lot more like some other horror movies that we've seen. And then
it doesn't seem very Spielberg to have the
daughter
in danger.
And then somehow he got two writers to write that screenplay, and that they were the two writers. I don't know how to pronounce the one guy's name, Michael Gross.
I think so.
And he became a producer, apparently.
Yeah, lots of producing credits.
And Mark Victor. So they were the ones that actually then took that and wrote a screenplay. Apparently, Steven wasn't too happy with their screenplay. And then he dove into it and rewrote it right before production and right before the thing went in production. And again, if you believe, you know, some of these things I found online, he rented a room. Kathleen Kennedy and all these other people were there giving him ideas, and he was hammering it out for like 1 week, and then that's what they went and shot.
Wow. But
a lot of this stuff gets mixed in.
Yeah,
with
it's hard to know.
Yeah.
But
this movie has a sordid history. Yeah. But I mean,
Even from the scripts, definitely after everything. But even it sounds like from the script standpoint, there was a lot of different iterations of it.
Yeah. The other funny thing is, and this is also out there, but there's an ET 2 treatment out there.
I've seen that.
And that came a little bit from Night Skies as well. It's called Nocturnal Fears, I believe.
Yeah.
And it was kind of this horror version of ET, like ET's mean spirited. You know,
it's so mutilating. Totally different.
Yeah. And then ET kind of is the hero, and it seems like it would be a bizarre movie.
Oh God!
I remember reading the Night Skies, like a giant article in Night Skies that led to that, and it was kind of the movie that was responsible for everything you love that never happened type of a write up. Yeah. And I remember it kind of feeding into the other one you just said.
Nocturnal Fears.
Yeah, because I remember both the names. I was like, I hate these titles.
If you look on Wikipedia, they kind of have its influences, and it says Gremlins and Back to the Future and all these other movies that kind of, you can take that with a grain of salt. They're probably all interests of Spielberg.
Right.
I don't know how much he directly lifted for any of these movies, but that's the way the story goes.
Man.
Well, still, it all resulted in, you know, probably what the most... I would say the most famous modern haunted house movie.
Yeah.
I mean, am I too old? Is 80s modern anymore?
Right.
I don't think it is. Maybe it's not.
It's not contemporary, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, to think about this movie in terms of haunted house movies, I was thinking of that myself. Like, what are the haunted house movies that even rival this? The Conjuring comes to mind.
Now.
Yeah. You mean contemporary, right?
Yeah.
Insidious, which heavily borrowed from Poltergeist.
Oh, yeah. And
Insidious made me think of Poltergeist.
Absolutely.
Because of the investigators.
I remember I just so happened to, back in, this isn't contemporary anymore, but back in the day, I just so happened to watch Sixth Sense after I watched Poltergeist because I was doing some ghost movie research, and they're so similar just in their like ambiance and aesthetic, and so that's one that's like sort of like a haunted house movie, but a haunted
I'm
not sure, you know, the Haunting, of course, the original Haunting, and then Amityville is the one I would think of instantly.
That was before Poltergeist though, or the remake of Amityville.
Is there, we're
now,
probably
besides
missing.
The Conjuring?
Besides the James Wan universe, the James Wan cinematic universe.
Yeah,
but
I mean, there's of course hundreds of them, you know, that we could name. Like, we could talk about House like that, which
I love. I love both
houses, but I don't consider them in the same type of movie as Poltergeist.
They're completely, totally different.
And there's a lot of like lower budget, like The Haunting in Connecticut,
right? A lot,
and there's a whole genre of like low budget.
But this one stands above.
I feel like I've seen a dime a dozen of movies where a white family moves into a new house and dad goes crazy and kid starts acting crazy. It's like
the Amityville structure.
Yeah.
And that's what's interesting about this one, because this one really is different than those other structures.
Yeah.
And I don't know, my take on why, on some of the reasons it's different, is because it kind of hits you between the eyes relatively early and says, this thing's really haunted. Yeah. It's not, we don't have that game of, is it haunted? Is it not? Yeah. Is it in my mind? Isn't it?
The debate isn't with the audience. The debate is only with the characters.
Yeah.
They're going around the neighborhood asking their, have you guys had any of this weird stuff right. happening? Right.
But that happens in the first act. Yeah. In a lot of these haunted house movies, that happens in the second
way
act.
Way later.
I was going to say, Jamie, like what you just said kind of parallels that scene, that great scene where the investigator says how he watched a toy car move across the thing, like over the course of 18 hours, he went like 6 feet, and then Craig Nelson just opens the door.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a parallel of that. Like, this is the movie you're watching. It's not, right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah. That's a great call.
Yeah.
That scene, it always kind of cracks me up because it could be, that scene could be in Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
It would almost.
It's the same effects as Ghostbusters. It has a Mago Hawk on a horse.
Yeah. Which is amazing how they thread the needle of that.
It's got almost a Gremlins feel in that scene.
Yeah.
Because the ghosts are like playing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, they have a sense of humor.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
You could see like Sam Raimi pulling that off.
Yeah.
Like, yes.
You know, kind of thing.
Well, is that what does separate this? Because it does have, it has the horror, it has the heart, it even has the laughs.
Yeah.
And it kind of pulls it all. The balance is perfect.
Right, right.
Like, it could be a disaster, but it somehow is not.
I think that's kind of what makes it so scary. Is it's, when I was a kid and I saw this movie, if I saw a scary movie, I'd literally close my eyes to miss the movie. This movie had this way about it that you didn't close your eyes because you were having fun.
Right. It's fun.
It was fun. You loved the characters. They were making you laugh. You were entertained. You were thrilled. And you were watching, and then really scary stuff would happen. And
it also kind of had the Spielberg spectacle that you don't want to miss.
Yeah.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's scaring you, but like, I don't want to miss the effect, the beauty of it. Yeah.
That's right. But somehow I kept my eyes open.
So one thing I wanted to ask, was this the first movie, because I just can't think of anything before this, that explored like technology as a means to the supernatural, the ghost in the machine?
Well, I there may have been ones before this. I can't think of one.
I feel like that's one of the things that this movie did.
I agree. I think
it's a comment on the times too.
Right.
Obviously, the way this opens and everything. Yeah.
My take on Poltergeist, and I think E.T. did this too. I had never heard the term extraterrestrial before E.T., and I had never heard the term poltergeist before. It's almost amazing because now we live in this kind of.
Or how about like slime with Ghostbusters?
Or slime, ectoplasm. Yeah, yeah. I didn't know these things. And now they're just like a little kid knows that because they play video games and they read comic
books. It's culture. Yeah.
But they were taking these weird terms out of science. And I remember even when I was a kid, I used to read up on parapsychology. It was like this. I always was like, maybe when I go to college, I'll study parapsychology. And then I'd read the books. I'd get the book from the library. It was really boring. And I was like, no.
It's not like cool ghost hunting adventures you go for.
But Spielberg had a way, Poltergeist, Close Encounters. He was stealing these little terms that people didn't hear about and saying, science knows about these.
Yeah.
We know about these. And it's almost like that thing in Superman where they said, you will believe a man can fly. It's almost like he said his thesis was, you will believe in ghosts. They are real. We're going to state our case.
There is life after death. Yeah.
We know a little more about.
So he's kind of bringing the audience behind the door.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think
like, here's the secret room. We're going to let you all in.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's so kind of interesting. Yeah.
I think you're right. I think there's a basis. And I think some of the scariest movies, The Exorcist is another one that comes to mind, are these movies that the director and the writers are like, this is a real thing. You don't know about it. We're going to open the door and we're going to tell a fictional story. But guess what? It really exists. And so you take it home with you.
I feel like Jurassic Park even did that.
Jurassic Park to an extent. But I never went home and feared a Tyrannosaurus.
But
I know what you're saying.
As a kid, that opened up my whole world to wanting to know about dinosaurs.
And DNA.
Yeah, DNA
something.
And all that. Right. Like, I had no concept of that until that movie.
Maybe not Google, because it was the 90s.
Yeah, no, I went to a library.
No, you'd hook your modem up and it would go. AOL. AOL search.
I'm just saying it opened up a whole different bunch of terms that I had never experienced as a kid. That was like so into dinosaurs.
Oh, definitely. And, investigators in pop culture before this movie?
Well, there was that Ghostbusters show with the monkey or whatever.
The first Ghostbusters.
The first Ghostbusters.
Which was also a live action movie with Larry Storch.
That's right. That's what I remember it as, actually.
Well, that's why that
TV show.
The TV show cartoon of the Ghostbusters.
Right. Well, I knew the thing before. It was on Sunday mornings, and they.
Well, that's why if you didn't know, they made a cartoon of that while the first movie was a hit.
The real Ghostbusters.
Yeah, that's why it's called the Real Ghostbusters, because they were like, no, we're gonna make our own cartoon.
But you know, and there are haunted house stories. Like I think of something like, is it The Legend of Hell House?
Yeah, yeah, it's a great movie.
That's a certain
great Richard Matheson.
You know, that has the investigators from the, you know, the 1930s.
That's true.
The SPR.
A little different, yeah.
House on Haunted Hill, maybe?
House on Haunted Hill.
Are they using technology?
Kind of pseudo technology.
Yeah, pseudo technology.
Another reason I say that is because the video cameras and stuff they kind of added in the remake.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah,
absolutely. It seemed like they're tapping into, like, how can we make. I just, to my mind, I can't think of a movie before this that says, okay, let's use video cameras to connect with the supernatural. Let's use television to connect. It, like, the ghost in the machine aspect.
As a human being who was literally born, like, almost near where this was released, this movie always strikes me, this strikes me so nostalgically, and I always view this movie as, like, pure Americana of the 80s. And
you're
the TV and the cameras and the way it's filmed, the fact that it looks just like all the other Spielberg movies that we already talked about.
Yeah.
There's something about the TV that brings me home, because I had that TV, that wooden TV that's in every living room in the 80s, you know. It's a perfect choice to just, like, ground everything in the time period and place.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think that's it. It's grounded, and much like Stephen King, this movie brings and Stephen King was doing this a little bit before him. But it's taking the haunted house out of the gothic, you know, cobwebby house, and he's putting it in your house.
Yeah.
And so you can
go
home.
Which is kind of what he's always done, right?
Yeah.
You bring it to the neighborhood.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I think what's instructive about this for writers, obviously Poltergeist is something we all know. But I think if you look at some of the spec sales out there, people often find these things that are just outside of our everyday reach that we want to learn about. So there's, like, this weird pseudo-educational aspect to their concepts. You know, if you can find that thing that's been untouched.
That's a good exercise,
Poltergeist. Yeah. You can then spawn your own films or stories from it.
Right. I can't wait for the Flat Earth movie.
Make your Flat own Earth. Monster in the house. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's the thing. They don't even have to be true. They just have to be, like, you know, pseudo true or something.
Know that there's people in this world that actually are doing these things, there's a connection there.
Yeah, yeah. And Terry Rossio, who I talk about his website a lot, website, he has a thing called mental real estate. And I always think of that in these terms. So mental real estate is, if you can be that movie that when people think of the haunted house movie or the dinosaur
movie. The shark movie.
The shark movie. Find your piece of mental real estate. And if you can find it, and it's not easy.
And it's not been used.
And it hasn't been used. And you can put your stake in it first, then you're in good shape. Yeah. Especially on spec screenwriting.
Yeah. Spielberg was kind of the master of doing that very thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How many of those movies has he honestly made?
Oh, so many.
There's at least like 10 I can think of, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? I mean,
all
every time Sony, you can't make
too,
a shark
God.
Movie. You can't make a shark movie and Jaws doesn't come up.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I guess, unless you're Sharknado 5 or something, but outside of those Sci-Fi Channel stuff, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if you make a real shark movie.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You already go in knowing that this will not be the best
shark
movie.
It's not
going
to be anything.
Right.
Sort of like, this is not going to, if you watch another ghost haunted house movie, this is not going to be Poltergeist.
Right. And the other thing I was thinking about with this is, we talked before about the monster in the house stuff. So monster in the house is that Blake Snyder term that he has of the elements of the monster in the house. And this is like a quintessential monster in the house. Because
it's
a house.
You know? Exactly.
So just to say, the monster in the house has three basic parts. It has a monster, which is, in this case, it's the ghost, the beast.
Right, the vengeful ghosts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, the unseen. They're unseen. Yeah.
It's kind of a gang of them in some ways, led by the beast.
We do see them, sort of. I mean, on that video.
Yeah.
We do. So there's the ghosts, or the poltergeists, or whatever you want to call them. They're really not poltergeists. There's the house, which is, in this case, it's an actual house, but sometimes it's a situation. And in some ways,
you could say the plot.
I'd say the plot is, because in this case,
Like her... the land plot, not the plot of the movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry. The neighborhood.
They only move the stones. Yeah.
Well, I was riffing off of your plot. The reason they're trapped is because their daughter's trapped in the closet. So it is kind of plot.
Yeah.
Traps them in. Right. Otherwise, they could just sleep. It's not a physical trapping. It's more situational. And then, where am I?
The sin.
Then the sin. The sin is the last one. And the sin is often the theme of the piece, which I'm... Poltergeist is weird because it's subtle with its theme.
Yeah.
So I'd say the sin is that disrespecting of the dead.
Right. Agreed.
It's funny.
But the characters that are paying for it aren't the characters that sinned.
Oftentimes that is the case.
That's the case, right? Yeah. I know. I'm just saying.
Yeah, it's true.
That's something to point out.
Like Jaws would be an example. Like,
right.
Those poor people that got eaten by the shark didn't necessarily decide not to close the beaches down or to hide the fact.
Yeah.
But in this case... especially on my rewatch, and maybe it's because I'm getting a little older and I'm viewing it more from the parents' angle, I do think there's a sin that the parents kind of commit. And I think it's that 80s sin. I think it's the fact that everybody was kind of living the high life and they were rich and they had a TV in every room, but they built it on the backs of somebody less fortunate. They disrespected somebody and didn't care and are oblivious to their disrespect. Because it kept showing this patriotic stuff, you know, in the Reagan book.
It comes off as a punishment for privilege.
Yeah.
Now, in like a more, I hate to use the word, but a more woke time in my life.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm watching and I'm like, yeah, it really does come off like punishing affluent white people. It does.
It's kind of like they have this rich life. They have this privilege and they're living these happy lives. They're living the American dream. But they're doing it on the backs of hurting somebody or taking something away.
Can I also point something out to go with what you're saying, which I always notice now when I watch it, is when they find out, the very beginning, when they find out something is weird about this house with the floor sliding thing.
Yeah.
I don't think it lets it get there, but you can tell that Craig T. Nelson's character is already thinking about how to exploit it. Like, I think they're like, our house is going to be famous. Mm-hmm. They're already in that 80s mindset where they're like, this is our ticket
monetizing
to a different life. And I'm like, they would definitely have TV cameras. Like Geraldo Rivera comes in and investigates the house. Like they're already, that's why they're like laughing when they're telling the, you know, the neighbor.
They're excited.
They found like a gold mine, that's a sin. That's the sin part of that whole thing. Right.
And it felt like the 80s were that, you know, euphoric time where we kind of forgot about those maybe sins of why we got to where we were.
Yeah.
And Poltergeist...
And they weren't thinking about the consequences. Yeah,
Poltergeist is almost the reckoning, right? It's like, it's going to come back and pay the price.
Yeah.
And do you think that comes from the... I forget their names. The guys you said, or do you think that... I feel like that would also come a little bit from Hooper. That seems like something Hooper would really throw in there.
That's a good point.
I don't think
that's not Spielberg mindset.
No offense to Spielberg, but I don't think he'd have that foresight to put something like the punishment of white privilege
There is a screenplay online. The screenplay does have the national anthem. It does have
wiping
off the tombstones, believe in the body. I'm not sure that it has the Reagan book, or maybe there's some other subtle touches that he threw in, like the way he... they production designed the rooms and things like that. I'm not sure about
that. Well, they're played as former hippies who are now Republicans.
Right.
Right.
That's right.
I think it's really important.
Yeah. I'm not sure if the screenplay has the let's smoke pot in the room. It might just have two people in the room, you know?
That's true.
I don't know.
They might have added that. That's a good call.
But it's a great character
out there, though.
It's
take
so
a look.
Good.
Yeah.
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 But that's...
I think you nailed that. I hadn't really given that as much thought upon the rewatch, but you know, when you say it out loud, it's there, it's all there.
I think the politics, it didn't hit me until later in life. The books and stuff and
rewatch.
Then and the whole, like, I was too young to understand the whole hippie verse growing up, like, my parents were kind of like that. They lived through the 60s and then they grew into Republicans. Old Republicans. So this movie, it brings back those memories of the adults in my life. That used to be.
Like you said, Jamie, the carefree 80s.
The carefree
80s. Yeah. Yeah.
Because
we
I was
won.
A kid.
Let's party.
Party. Like
I was
said,
a kid,
on the
so that's how
those...
I viewed them.
We got ghosts. Let's make a TV show about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The script doesn't really go there, but I always theorize that they would do something. Like Current Affair would come there.
Right. Like, yeah, that's a good call. Like you said, the wheels are in
motion in Craig T. Nelson's head. Of what can we did it? We struck the gold. Yeah.
There was when I was a kid, there was actually a story about a girl who had poltergeist powers that became a big news story. Her name was like Tina Reisch. I think it's R-E-S-C-H, I think. And if you Google her, there's even a book called the St. Louis Poltergeister. It's not St. Louis.
Poltergeister?
Yes, I have read about this.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's a book about her, but she was faking it. But all the news places came, and there's this like Inquirer magazine photo that I saw when I was a kid that gave me chills, and I totally believed it because news is real, right? And it was like a phone being thrown across the room. And apparently all she did in the book, later on it kind of explained, is she would just grab things when people weren't looking and throw them and like this, and people would go, oh my God, it's a ghost. And they'd take a picture of it in the air. And everybody thought this was a real poltergeist. And at some point she was caught throwing a lamp across the room.
In more innocent times. People believe a photo.
Yeah, but it stuck with me to this day. I can remember seeing that and it blowing my mind and changing my world. I was like, poltergeists are real.
They're real.
I mean, people believe that Bigfoot photo.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
You don't believe that?
Well, they admit it. I kind of wish that those guys never admitted it.
Oh, I know.
So it could just always
be
up in the air, you know? That's like the stuff that makes life worth living,
yeah,
the wonder.
It makes our world bigger, yeah.
That's the ship at the end of Close Encounters, you know? Do you get on it or don't you? You know, that's what that is. And when like the Amityville woman admits it was all a scam, you're like, God, don't do that. Just lie to me. Give me something, you know? Life is boring enough.
I know you touched on earlier what makes this movie scary, but I wanted to talk about some stuff that we haven't talked about.
Okay, absolutely.
Upon rewatching, because when I think poltergeist, I think of the fun factor, right? I don't think of a deeper thing that it hits on, but it touches on like the three main fears that we all have, right? So like as adults who have kids, parents, like what's your worst fear? That you're going to lose your kid, right? And there's nothing you can do to save them, right? Because they're in another world.
And the movie figures out a way for them to lose their child and for the child to be right there dangling in front of them.
So, you know, something Stephen King did in a lot of his work, and actually, and I didn't add this in the beginning, Stephen King, there was talk of him actually writing the screenplay early on.
Oh,
he would have
been great.
Yeah, it ended up not working.
I'm happy that it is what it is. I don't want it to change.
I know.
I can know what you're saying. But I don't want Stephen King to touch this one.
But
that's my opinion. I'm sorry.
So
it would have been
set in
Maine.
There's that, right? right.
I wouldn't
Rock,
be able to even feel
been,
like
it would have been Castle
it
Rock.
Been Castle
yeah.
Rock. Yeah, yeah.
Instead of the E.T. neighborhood,
right?
And then the second thing it does is it hits on children's worst fears, which is the monster in your closet.
Good point.
The monster under your bed, the unknown, like the storm outside, the darkness. So you get all of the parents' worst fears, all of the children's worst fears.
Hold on, though.
Yeah.
The one thing this movie doesn't do, which a lot of these haunted house movies doesn't take on the children's worst fear of their parents.
That's a good call.
This movie does not turn the parents against the children.
Everybody has each other's back in this movie.
I like that.
No, but I'm saying that's an important thing to note because a lot of these movies have, like, the dad starts going insane. You know, you can't trust those. The people that you trust to feed you and take care of you turning against you. This movie's not about that.
Yeah, someone with a different upbringing would have written it differently, yes.
Stephen
that's
King.
That's all I just wanted to note
good
that.
Call.
Yeah.
Stephen King would have had the father beating
you. Yeah.
No, and that's exactly. And that's why
you're right. That's true. And as a guy who had great parents, I don't fear that. So that didn't even come to my mind.
Right.
Like, that's not something I think about that I can't trust my parents. My parents are amazing. They'll never listen to this. My dad doesn't believe people go to the movies to watch characters. That's a whole other subject.
Go boy. Jimmy's been rebelling his whole life from that statement.
Next week our special guest.
Mr. George.
And then the third thing is, what's everyone's worst fear? Death. Mm-hmm. Right? Or most
public
people.
Public speaking.
No, but everyone fears death. Everyone fears death, right? Or most people fear death until they make their peace with it, right?
And
I think
clowns.
A lot of this movie and clowns. Karl Rapovia was in there.
Yeah.
But a lot of this movie for me it felt like it's like trying to say that there's peace in death. Mm-hmm. Kind of like there's, you know, the speech with the that what's her name gives.
Yeah. A beautiful moment
about,
in the movie.
Yeah, yeah. Is all
where
about
where she like she reassures the whole audience that
even
it's gonna
though it's
be
scary
okay.
as shit, kind of the things that she's talking about, there's also something beautiful about what she's talking mm-hmm. about. And like when it's your time, you know, you have to turn to the light. And I also think that also goes to like respecting the dead.
I always know. Now, do you guys know about that story about Kubrick and how he viewed The Shining? How he viewed The Shining as a positive movie, only because the way he viewed it was that if anything proves life after death, then life itself is positive because this isn't it. And I always took that.
I kind of view the paranormal that way. And
yeah,
I always took because they were great friends. So I always took that speech. I don't know how that probably was in the script, but I always took that speech as like kind of a nugget of what. Yeah. Like, what if he took that from Kubrick? Because she's basically saying, yeah, this is all terrible, but there is life
there
after
is life.
There is light after this.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like,
this
it was weird.
This is good news.
Yeah, exactly. This is
yeah,
good
this
news.
Horror that we're experiencing is actually, like, a really
now
positive
you,
thing.
Now you don't have to fear death in the same
yeah,
way.
Yeah, there's more.
It's a very peculiar message.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's they explore that throughout
the And I think that's another great lesson learned for writers, because when you're approaching these horror movies, get personal.
Yeah.
With whatever scares the crap out of you, go for that. Go for that. I mean, I always tell people that I used to do a lot of body horror stuff, and it was because, you know, I had a father who had MS, and he, you know, he had all these different things that had to happen to him and losing his body functions and stuff. So a lot of it was like The Fly, you know, right. And I never realized that's what I was tapping into. But I think I had a fear of medicine. I had a fear of our bodies failing us. So a lot of the stuff I initially did in horror was body horror, because I think that's one of the things that truly terrified me.
Did Pet Sematary affect you as a kid?
As a kid, yeah.
Yeah.
Pet Sematary.
Well, the certainly. Sister I'm talking
yeah,
about.
The yeah, the sister. Zelda.
Well,
oh, my
God.
I mean, it's terrifying to me.
No, my father didn't have MS until more my adult years. So when I started to write.
Okay.
But Pet Sematary is terrifying.
It's a terrifying movie regardless.
So. Probably one of the scariest books I've ever written.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's honestly, I think it's the movie
I wrote
that...
Pet Sematary.
I didn't know that, Jamie.
It's the movie
shit.
That I think
I
scares me
the
most.
The
I don't think
it's for me. It's the scariest
like,
movie.
I don't think any movie scares me as much as that.
It's my favorite horror book. The movie is not as much, but I love the book.
I'm not, it's not my favorite movie. It just scares me.
I gotcha.
There's a tone to it.
But back to
Poltergeist.
So another thing I wanted to touch on is the slow burn pacing of the scares.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really good lesson, because I read a lot of scripts that they kind of like put it all up front.
Yeah.
And they don't save the best for last, and there's no escalation. You sort of have these amazing, awesome sequences that kind of inspired the script, and then that's it. You have like 40 pages with nothing cool. And this story is like a great example of how every single like beat things get worse, you know, and the like the escalation of the monster premise just like gets more and more.
Also, I feel like every scare has a Chekhov's gun.
Yes,
I really feel like they set up every scare in the movie earlier.
Oh yeah,
movie.
In the first act. Yeah,
which,
definitely.
Yeah. Which to me speaks to, I think it's using that dread thing we talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in the beginning, there's no overt supernatural in play. Even I was even surprised in my rewatch, because I don't really remember it this way, was that when she went up to the TV at first and she's saying the creepy stuff. That's not necessary. I mean, it is supernatural because of the sound, but there's nothing hugely overt that happens
right.
in that scene. It's just creepy.
It's
right?
in your mind.
It's in your mind.
Yeah.
And then from that point, probably until that earthquake kind
the
of
earthquake.
Thing. It's just dread stuff. It's just planning. Oh, there's a creepy clown in the corner. Right. Oh, look at that weird tree.
Look
Why is
that,
he staring at
look
it?
Look at that steak throwing up.
You said, Bob, something feels off. In that first act,
if something feels off.
You're
and
only given, you're not given any evidence that something's off, but something feels off.
And
that's usually a great horror movie, though. When everything is normal as it should be, and it feels wrong.
Right.
And that's one of these things that a lot of writers leave out of their first drafts, because I think they think the director is going to bring that by lighting and just shooting weird angles. But those things are in the script.
Yeah,
I mean,
definitely.
The weird clown, the gnarled tree, the lightning storm. These are all in the script.
Yep.
And they're just
every scare is set up.
Yeah.
Everything's set up. And then all that stuff pays off in that, you know, big scene where she gets
sucked
into the closet.
Yeah.
Or at least most of that stuff pays off.
A lot
off.
Of that stuff, yeah.
Or it pays off later. That said, one of the weird things about Poltergeist is it goes big early. And no. I'm not sure if it really gets back up to that level until...
No, there's a lull. There's definitely a lull.
There's a lot of exposition. There's a lot of speeches about death. Yeah. There's a lot of sadness. And it sustains.
But I was going to say, it's captivating nonetheless.
It's captivating, yeah. But it's an unusual choice. And I bet you, if I looked at it, and I haven't in a while, that the Poltergeist remake probably tries to smooth that all out.
Right, no, I can tell you that, having seen it twice, I can tell you it does.
Yeah.
The way I feel about it, it's kind of like Poltergeist has this like lump of butter on the toast, and then they probably smoothed it all around the toast a little bit.
They made it more generic. Yeah, yeah.
And they probably tried to use screenwriting tools to fix that problem.
Yeah.
That really wasn't a problem.
It's not a problem.
Yeah.
No, the difference makes it special.
Right.
The difference makes it
really
special.
Does. It really does. Yeah.
And similarly, not to jump to it, but the end is one of these things that always kind of got to me, because there's that whole, you know, this house is clean moment.
But isn't that what makes this movie great, is that it could end right there and be a satisfying movie.
Yeah.
That's what I always love
about
it.
That's all you need.
I always think of Die Hard when I think of Poltergeist too, because I'm like, this is the dude coming back to life.
Right
at the end, so that Carl Winslow could shoot him. Yeah. You know, like it's just like, oh, it's over, fine, and then oh, it's not.
Except it's like 10 more minutes.
Right, it's like a full act.
It's like it's like a full short film, haunted house short film. After that,
and then it was like, we're just gonna open the floodgates and let you have it. We're gonna let you have every.
It's like the ghost taking that last right hook, just like.
Oh yeah, it's a big ass right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And it's not, I mean, I'm trying to think of other movies that have fake endings that are actually effective. Raiders of the Lost Ark, to me, when I saw that as a kid, I couldn't figure out when that movie was going to end. Because after that truck scene, I said, this movie must be over. That's how movies end. You know, it's this great moment. I see the biggest stunt. It's the most thrilling. I'm the most excited.
If it was the 50s, you would see the title come up.
That would be it. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And I couldn't figure out how that movie was going to end. So another Spielberg movie. Maybe... because that was a little serialized as well.
Right, serialized. Well,
this one's not serialized.
No, not at all.
We were talking earlier about sin and you know, that being the force pushing everything forward. With the second ending, I always kind of took it as the sin of just not leaving the house.
Yeah.
The fact that the parents were so comfortable with that being the end of the movie themselves.
Right. That's a good point.
Like, the gall to stay there
to stay.
Is such a sin of, I don't know, stupidity or just bad judgment.
Right.
To let your
it's
children.
It's once again disrespecting.
They don't respect what happened. They let her sleep in that room again.
Yeah.
It's like.
Yeah.
It seems, I think it was a bit of a stretch, to be honest with you, as far as screenwriting. I'm
you
not
mean
sure.
Plausibility?
Plausibility.
That they would stay there.
Yeah. It also always bothered me that they let the kid stay in the house with them. I mean, I can understand not getting a babysitter, but this is pretty, your other kid has been sucked into a closet.
Yeah.
it's kind of negligent. Both parts are negligent in a way.
Yeah. I think that's a good point.
I'll disagree with you only because I think it characterizes the parents properly.
Yeah,
I think
the disrespect is consistent.
I think that, their respect isn't there for anything. They just experienced everything you possibly could,
and then they're safe now.
The expert said it was clean, and it's fine now.
The only thing I'd say, and this goes back to when we talked a couple weeks ago about Sam Raimi's rules of horror. Remember what the last one was? It was, you have to taste blood to be a man. I always think this was kind of the rite of passage.
Okay.
Where they learned respect.
Yeah,
through
definitely.
This process. But then after the process, again, they didn't respect me. They just stayed in the house.
Yeah.
That's disappointing to me because I felt like they'd learned a lesson. I felt like they were changed people.
Yeah.
And I honestly don't think they're not changed people. I just think the writer needed them to stay in the house
extra
a little bit.
10 minutes of I think madness.
She got like, you know, she got her cool hairstyle.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm not ragging on the movie. I'm glad they stayed in the house. Yeah. I wanted to see the end. Yeah. I love the fake ending. And all that's all good. But there's a part of me that I think the writer needed them to stay in that house.
The movie, I remember seeing the movie 1408, Stephen King, and what I loved about that is the same deal, is that it has the fake ending where you think everything's fine. Mm-hmm. And when I saw that movie, I'll never forget, the guy sitting behind us was like, right when that ending was just wrapping up, he goes, well, that was great. And he walks out. So now I just always think about that dude who's walking around in the world thinking 1408 ends right there, you know? But then, yeah, then the movie totally just rushes right back at you.
Right.
That kind of reminded me of Poltergeist when I first saw it. That
maybe in this day and age, this would be a post-credit sequence.
No, this would be like the 10-point finale instead of the five that we're seeing often.
Right.
That's right.
You think because it's doubles down on it?
Oh, yeah. It's just an extra.
In a weird sort of way, the Hightower surprise
is the ghost.
Is the fact that this is clean isn't the end.
Right. That's a good call. Yeah.
This supernatural weird lady that is from some other planet who said everything was fine, who you'd trust because how could she not?
Right.
Was wrong.
Was wrong. Yeah, it's worse than we thought.
Also, there's like visual cues too, like the whole way that it opens up on the TV screen. Mm-hmm. You know that this movie's not ending until that TV screen comes back.
That's a good call.
That's the old opening and closing image.
Closing image, yeah.
Right, though? I mean, yeah. We knew it. We didn't feel it.
Yeah.
You know something's wrong.
It's a good call.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it what's left to say about Poltergeist, guys?
Do you have anything else, Jimmy?
Let's see. I mean,
lessons learned.
One thing that I loved about it that we didn't touch on is, once again, it's a great lesson of the premiseless building that we've talked about in the previous episodes, where they're like, here's a family and a house. And like I said, okay, we're going to explore three things. We're going to explore parents' fears, child's worst fears, and fear of dying in a house. Mm-hmm. And how are all the ways we could maximize that, right? With the premise, your TV is against you, the lamp, the furniture, the kids' toys,
the
food in your fridge, the tree outside, the pool in your backyard. I mean, you can just see the list being made, you know, you can see the construction. And then another thing that we didn't talk about real quick that I just wanted to say, like, I love the idea that you can't kill the monster. It's a monster movie where the monster is fucking
untouchable,
dead, right?
Like, the only way to kill the monster is to close the door.
Right, to close the door, but also to basically, it's not in your power to like convince them to like go to the light. You know, you have to seek out other people. I just love the fact that like they literally cannot defeat this monster. I think that's like unique to this story, because usually when you're watching a monster movie, like that's the first thing: how do we kill it? You know,
and also that's just something to add to that, Jimmy. Like, the people that are brought in first are so in over their head they can't even touch this
right
thing. Then they bring in the big guns, which is Zelda Rubinstein, and she apparently does it, but then we learn that she didn't even
you
know. She's also, I didn't mention this before, she's an excellent example, and the monster in the house, there's this person called a half man, and we've talked about it before. And the half man is usually a mentor that's faced the beast before and has information on how to defeat it. Oftentimes they come in, sometimes around the midpoint, sometimes earlier. But she definitely is, and she's half the size of a normal.
The perfect. No, but I mean,
she's literally half person, right?
But it's true. It's true. Yeah, she's a perfect half man. I didn't think about that. Good call, Jamie. Yeah,
just hear Bob say that. She definitely is.
Yeah, but so those were the two things that I just love how they made everyday, like, domestic thing. They just took the domestic haunted house premise and they maxed it out, man. They maxed it out.
Yeah, and that's the key. You know, we talked
two
about
masters
it
maxed yeah. it out. Two masters. Yeah.
We talked about before how many screenplays would just have all the other ghost beats that we see in other things. We, you know, knocking on the walls.
Right.
Or, you know, but in this one, they went in and they looked. They said, here's what's unique about our story.
Right.
You know, let's squeeze every ounce of juice out of that, so that when Jamie Nash comes in 2018 and tries to write a haunted house screenplay, he has to dig a lot deeper. He cannot do it without everybody saying, they already did that in Poltergeist.
Yeah.
I mean, try to write a better mother-daughter love story. You know, like, it's like more convincing than most movies that just try to do that normally.
Drama.
You're right. And,
yeah,
and drama.
No,
and this
no
is
genre.
Like, this movie almost brings me to tears with the two of them. Yeah, you know, just that.
There's something weird that in this movie that we don't see anymore, that there's almost no conflict in the family.
No, I know. Family,
everybody has each other's backs. The ghost hunters have each other's backs. They have the family's backs.
The husband and wife are desperately in love.
Yeah.
That's the aspect of this movie that I've always adored.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. Because once again,
the Haunted House movies. I guess it's because there's so much against them. You couldn't have the internal antagonism.
You need the structure of that family to stay standing.
You could see a version of this movie. Sam Rockwell, I'm looking at you.
That's what I didn't like about that.
Where the dad was a jerk.
And a drunk. And,
yeah, it's your fault. You know, you're to blame.
They turned it into Amityville Horror with that kind of aspect. Right. Except he was not haunted. He was just a fucking loser.
I would argue most writers, that would be their instinct. Because it gets more juice out of those middle scenes.
Yeah.
You know, you need that arc. And
You need that conflict, the internal antagonism.
Mr. Freeling's, his sin isn't like being a loser. His sin is hubris.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In life. You know, and this whole movie is about humbling that character to me.
Yeah, that's good. Mm-hmm.
I think when he pushes that TV at the end, he is a humbled, different man.
Definitely.
Like, he respects everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good call.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything else, guys?
No, I think...
It's hard to talk about a movie you love so much.
Yeah.
I guess my lesson learned thinking about this is make your horror personal. Yeah. Right? If you're writing a horror movie, dig deep. Think what scares you, because whatever scares you is going to scare people.
We're
going to
get
there.
So many Trump movies.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
And Purge is doing it. Right?
Yeah. You know, you can be metaphorical with that scare, but also if you're literal, if you're scared of lightning and thunder, if you're scared of a tree, if you're scared of clowns, think of it. Get personal. Get very specific. Dig deep on this.
I think that's perfect.
Make the list, as Jimmy.
The list.
Make a list of things
in
your house.
I have no problem
that you feared.
Repeat talking about this just because, as a guy who reads scripts all day, I just read two yesterday from people who are trying to make their way into this business. People don't do that. They don't deliver on the promise of the premise. It's like one of the main problems with amateur screenwriting. So, yeah. The list. What's your premise? How can you max that out? Period. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think... If we talk any longer, we'll just start repeating and keep loving on this movie's private parts.
Yeah.
Right. Thanks, guys. This was great. I don't think I've ever done a podcast where I at length talked about a movie I loved this much.
Aww.
So I enjoyed it. That's
good.
I mean, me too. I'm always afraid to talk about stuff I love. So
we weren't going to talk shit up about it. We love it.
No, exactly.
I'm sure anyone listening is like, "Why hated that movie?"
Yeah.
Both the guys suck. Conjuring rules. You're right. All right, guys. Thanks.
All right, thanks.
Bye-bye.
You have just listened to Writer's Blockbusters, a screenwriting podcast featuring two professionals and another guy. Available only on Thundergrunt.